from Waurika, Oklahoma.
God bless.
My name's Cleve Largent, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, and because of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of conventions like this, and because of people like you, I haven't had a drink today. And for that, I'm very grateful. And if you'd known me 33 years ago, you'd be very grateful, too. I'm real happy to be here. When I come back to the Carolinas, it's kind of like old home week. I was talking to Dave. I first met Dave in 1969. I introduced him at the state conference in Arkansas. I didn't meet Hal at the time, but we attended the same conference in 1967 in Lubbock, Texas. And I've known Hal off and on ever since. And I don't know the first time I met Buck in Virginia. I know they visited with us. We took them rodeoing, and I just got a lot of good friends that I've met in the past here. And I just love coming back. Right now, there's no place on God's green earth I'd rather be than right here. And there's no group of people I'd rather be with than you. And without sounding totally inflated, there's no one I'd rather be than me. hadn't always been that way. There was a time when I don't care where I was getting ready to go somewhere else. And I don't care who I was with, I was trying to figure out a way to get rid of them and go find somebody that understood me. And I sure wasn't happy with me. I drank hundreds of gallons of that liquid detergent trying to change who I was and what I was, unsuccessfully. But tonight, I just feel like I'm where I'm supposed to be. And I'm with the people I should be with. I'm from Waurika, Oklahoma. That is a Choctaw Indian word, Waurika, that means running water. And I've got to tell you this so that you can understand my attitudes on some things. Waurika sits right atop the 98th meridian that separated Indian Territory from Oklahoma Territory. And the outlaws that hanging Judge Roy Parker out of Fort Smith, Arkansas, that had jurisdiction over the Indian Territories, all the outlaws he was after ran over to, and we're right on the Texas border, too, ran over to where I live. I didn't live there then, but lived there. Then all the people in Oklahoma Territory that the U.S. Marshals were after ran to the same line, kind of like Texarkana, Arkansas, you know. And if this marshal got too close, they just went over across the meridian. And if both sides got too hot, they just went to Texas. But we've got a bunch of fine people there. They're a little peculiar, I'm sure, that you back here in North Carolina would think. And Jefferson, Waurika is the county seat of Jefferson County. Big ranching county. And I've got a lot of, three-fourths of vehicles there are pickups. And big ranches. And working cowboys and Levi's and boots with spurs. And pickups have got gun racks in the back. With guns in them, and lots of honky-tonks, beer joints, country western music, I know I used to listen to some of the old-timers talk about Waurika. They said it's a hub of the plains, where the pavement ends and the west begins, where their men are men and women wouldn't have it any other way. And when I mention women, I guess the time is appropriate to introduce my wife again, because I will refer to her from time to time. Nell, stand up and let them get a good look at you. I will tell you that I am a retired state trial judge. I spent some 6 years as a magistrate back in the early 50s, and then I was the prosecutor for a number of years. Then I became a state trial judge and served 18 straight years on the higher bench. Nell's a judge, too. Up until recently, when she resigned, she was the municipal judge of the city of Waurika. And she was the town judge of Ryan, Oklahoma, which is 10 miles south of Waurika. It's kind of a have gavel, will travel situation, you know. I usually tell a story about along there. And she doesn't like it and tells me not to tell it, but I'm going to tell it anyway. It seems that they brought these three weekend drunks down in front of this old cross-eyed judge. There's three of them. And he looked at the one on the end and said, "What's your name?" The one in the middle said, "Harry Brown." He said, "I didn't ask you." And the one on the other end said, "I didn't say nothing." That one usually reminds me of the good Oklahoma rooster out in the barnyard, and he was chasing this old hen and this young hen around the barnyard. He's cross-eyed, old cross-eyed rooster. And the old hen turned to the young one and said, "Hun, we better slow up and run together, or he might miss both of us." But we have a distinctive citizen in southern Oklahoma. 1 year, 1 12-month period that I just happened to take it out and look at it, I tried 4 first-degree murder, capital murder cases, death by homicide by firearms. And incidentally, during the terms, I tried 4 simple little cattle theft cases. It wasn't a big rustling operation. It was some old boy just went out and got him a couple of calves, you know. In the 4 murder cases, all 4 of the defendants were acquitted by a jury of 12 of their peers, found not guilty, justifiable. And all 4 of these kids that had stolen 1 or 2 little old calves were convicted and sentenced to the state prison at hard labor. Now, that's the way we look at things in my end of the country. We now have a law that's on the statute book. It's called the Make My Day Law. They named it after something Clint Eastwood said one time, that you come around fooling around my house and put me in apprehension, and I can kill you right there. And they can't do anything about it. So if you don't come fooling around me, don't come to my house, you know. But they have a very strange attitude, and that's the community that I grew up in. I had a most outstanding childhood. Never was very big, but I was an overachiever, and I made outstanding grades in school. I was a good musician. I took part in dramatics and orations and debating. And quarterback the winning football team at 125 pounds, and was runner-up in the state Golden Gloves as a bantamweight. I did everything I did real hard. And the Sunday that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, I was playing a trumpet concerto on a fine arts recital. And, of course, that changed my life. I was a senior in high school. And as soon as I got out of high school, I was still too young to get in the Air Force, and that's what I wanted to do. So I went to university for a part of a semester. But I really hated to leave home, too, because my dad was a fine, fine man. I never will forget he told me one time, he said, "You can be anything in this life that you want to be if you're willing to pay the price." Anything. No dream's impossible if you're willing to pay the price. And my mother was a fine little Irish gal, Methodist. We lived across the street from the Methodist church. And every time those chimes rang, well, that was get ready and come on. You know, we were there. And every evening after the evening meal, we always read a few passages of Scripture. I had an older sister. I don't talk too much about her because we were never that close in my childhood. She was 4 years younger than I was, and I was her little brother, and she constantly reminded me of that. But she's a dear gal, though. Just a real good life. And I didn't think that the war would change me in any way. Well, when I got to be 18 and a half years old, I enlisted as the Army Air Corps then in cadet training, and some 15 months later, after 15 glorious months in Texas in training, I received my commission as a second lieutenant in my pilot's wings. Now, normally when you go through cadet training, you get at least a leave before you get your next assignment. Well, I didn't. The war was going on, and they said there's 363 in this graduating class. 350 have orders, and you'll get leave, and there's 13 of you have been specially selected, and you'll be your earmark for direct overseas shipment. So I was one of the 13, and I went directly overseas. And I got to Italy, and they put me in a replacement depot. I was supposed to go to a B-25 outfit, and I came in an old C-47, DC-3, and picked up about 10 or 12 of us, and we took off, didn't know where we was going, and we ended up in Brindisi, Italy, which is the start of the Appian Way, the road to Rome. They jump off from Corinth and come across to Brindisi, but they had a secret base there that was operated by the Office of Strategic Services under British control. And I know the colonel, a very young colonel, told us, he said, "Now, what you have to do is not particularly difficult. You either fly strip down B-25s or you fly 47 transports. You'll fly over into Yugoslavia, Albania, and Greece, and northern Italy, and you'll drop agents. You'll go back and supply the agents by paradrops. And then at times you will be landing behind enemy lines and picking up people. You won't have any fighter escorts. You'll do this at night. You'll do it alone. The guns you're flying, the planes you're flying won't have any guns on them. And just don't get shot down and get caught, because they'll shoot you if you're taken prisoner." Well, I'm 19 years old, you know. This is really something to look forward to. my first mission. We got flacked up pretty good and big holes in the airplane. I was flying co-pilot for Captain Paul Davidson. He got killed 2 weeks to the day later. But on that first mission, we came back in and went into debriefing. And the intelligence officer, had a table just like this with whiskey bottles sitting on it and glasses. The old, big old barrel glasses like we used to have in restaurants, you know, with the rib bottom, thick things. I said, "What's that, Captain?" I asked Captain Davidson. He said, "That's combat ration." He says, "Pour your glass full and drink it." Well, I wasn't a hard liquor man. I may have sipped a beer or two as a kid, but not very many. And I drank that glass full of, it was Gibson's Rye Whiskey. I never will forget that. And it was either that or Bella's Reserve or Three Feathers or something colored and flavored with wood chips. But I drank that glass of booze, and in 5 minutes, I became Eddie Rickenbacker II. That intelligence officer asked a question, and I answered it. He asked another question, and I answered it and the next three before we ever got them out. And in the history of my outfit, I was the only pilot officer they ever asked to leave debriefing. Then I went back to the squadron area, got there about daylight, and while some of the boys went down to that end of the Quonset to have their powdered eggs and Spam for breakfast, I went to the other end, beat on the bar, woke up the Italian bartender that slept back there. And I drank a little cognac and vermouth, and gin and vermouth, and rum and vermouth. And they took me up and poured me in my cot about 9:30. And I got very sick, terribly sick. And I swore I would never do that again. It was that doggone Italian rum and gin and vermouth that did it to me. Well, we played a game. I got to hustle through this, but we played a game that if you would fly 5 missions, not drink your combat ration, you could have a full fifth. Now, it doesn't work out that way, but seriously, there were enough of those kids, and that's all we were. We flew an airplane like the kids drive a Stingray today. There were enough kids played that game that every time I flew 5 missions, I got my fifth, because 3 or 4 of them hadn't gotten back from their 2nd, 3rd, or 4th. And I would take that fifth, get me a couple of Cokes, an old Army 45, and a Jeep, and I'd drive up the Adriatic coastline, Adriatic Sea coastline, find a deserted spot, and I'd tie that old 45 down low, and I'd bow my legs just a little bit, and I'd honk on that bottle pretty hard, you know, and then I'd walk along the beach and quick draw and shoot the sand lizards. And I was Hoop Gibson or Tim McCoy, Johnny Mac Brown. In fact, we had to shoot out at the OK Corral over there a couple of times. But I'd get tired of playing cowboys and Indians, you know, and I'd turn the collar on my shirt up, become sinister, and I'd be Dick Tracy, and I'd wipe out the underworld. Then I'd run out of ammunition, and I'd walk along the seaside, and I remember my mother told me about this Greek that had an impediment of speech. And he used to put a pebble under his tongue and talk to the ocean, the pounding surf. Well, I'd put a pebble under my tongue and walk along and deliver dramatic declamations to the Adriatic Sea. And I'd get tired of that, and the bottle would get pretty low, and the sun would get pretty low. And I'd find the highest sand dune I could find, and I'd stand up there and watch the little sailing vessels, a little Italian fishing fleet come back in. And I'd stand up there, and just like Bing Crosby, I'd sing Red Sails in the Sunset. I tell you that because that was a very important reaction I had to beverage alcohol. Not too unlike from that that many of you have known. Because for that brief period, it made me who I wanted to be, where I wanted to be, how I wanted to be, when I wanted to be. Just anything I wanted to be, I could be for that booze. I forgot about that when I finally got home for a while, but then came along a moment of stress, and I wasn't happy with the way things were, and I knew I could change it. I don't want to fight World War II because that's 50 years ago, you know, a long time ago. But I had an experience that changed my life at the time and continues daily to change my life. I was flying a mission way up north of Bosnia, Yugoslavia, and going into land. Incidentally, that would have been my 20th landing mission behind enemy lines had I completed it. And we were letting down to, in the valleys, the Dinaric Alps, very mountainous, letting down to land, and a German night fighter equipped with radar ran right up our tail. Now, the reason we were landing is because we were carrying 5-gallon cans of gasoline. This is in a C-47 transport ship. 5-gallon cans of gasoline, rifle ammunition, and a few crates of hand grenades going in to supply one of Tito's guerrilla armies. And this night fighter ran right up our tail, and you talk about remembering how it used to be. I can stand here right now and feel those tracers go right by my ear into the firewall. He opened up with his machine guns, got it right on us, tripped the switches on 4 forward-firing 20-millimeter cannon, and in 5 seconds, that plane was held in 13%. It went up. We had 800 gallons of 100-octane gasoline in aluminum gas tanks. It didn't even have self-sealing gas tanks. And immediately the control surfaces were burned away, and we were helpless, busted in the air, and gave the order to bail out. And I got up, and I didn't wear a parachute, just a harness. I got up, got my pack, and snapped it on. Had 2 hooks here in front. And the other pilot and I stood there in the companionway door as the navigator was trying to get his chute on. The radio operator was dead. We could tell that. The dispatcher and the engineer we never saw because the back end of the plane then was red hot. And just looked back. It looked like my thoughts of hell. And we just kind of stood there, stunned, not really nowhere getting out. And the plane started tumbling, and I ended up in the back end. And there were a series of explosions, and I looked up at the prettiest starry sky that you ever saw. A whole section of fuselage had been blown away. And I found something to get my feet against, and I dived. And I never had made a parachute jump before. They used to do that in training, you know, pilot training. You had to make a parachute jump. But the boys were tearing up their knees and breaking their legs and rubbing their ankles. Finally, somebody real smart in the Pentagon said, "Why practice something you have to do right the first time anyway?" And so I never made a parachute jump, but I'd read the book. And it said, after you're sure that you're clear of the aircraft, grasp the D-ring or the ripcord firmly and pull. Well, I'm out of the airplane, and I reach the ripcord, and it's not there. For about that long, I tried to get back in the airplane. But I clawed at my pack, and in my frenzy, I'd put it upside down and backwards. The rip cord was over here. Now, it'll work. All that stuff comes off and hits you in the face. And I don't know how fast I was traveling through the air, 300 miles an hour probably at the time that chute opened. And it was a tremendous jerk. And I was swinging violently, and I looked up just as the airplane hit the mountain. Wasn't too far from me. And it hit the mountain at just the angle of the mountain. It just plowed a furrow right down. And I just kept watching. Just kept going down, 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 and down, spewing burning gasoline, exploding cans, and hand grenades, and rifle ammunition in all directions. Then it hit the bottom, and there was a big explosion and a big fire. And I look up, and I swing right into the side of a mountain. And I put my right foot out to brace myself because I'm going to hit this big rock. And I remember thinking, just before I passed out, I believe that bent the wrong way. Anyway, I fall down into this gorge, and I kind of wake up, and my first sensation was that of burned hair. I could smell burned hair, and it was mine. My crew cut was considerably shorter than Dave's, and you put a blowtorch to that for about 5 seconds, and you slick as a cue ball. And that's what happened to me. But I gathered my chute under me and huddled up there in the rocks, and by then there was a truck had pulled up at the crash down in the valley, and I was absolutely scared to death. That was the first time in my life I had ever been alone. Never before. I'd always had my scoutmaster, my band director, my boxing coach, my football coach, even my older sister. I'd always had somebody, but I didn't have anybody. And I wondered why I was still alive. I knew the other five hadn't made it. I knew that. And why was I still alive, laying up here on the side of a mountain to be captured and killed? And in my desperation, I said, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? The burning of the wreckage in the valley, quite a fire, was silhouetting the peaks. I could see the peaks. And I thank God for this Methodist mother that reared me right. Because when I said, what am I going to do? The words of the psalmist came to me. I shall lift up mine eyes into the hills. From whence cometh my help? My help comes from God that made heaven and earth. And I said, God, I don't know why I'm still alive. Maybe sometime, somewhere, you got something for me to do. But I can't do it here. And it's a long ways back. But I'll do everything within my power to get back and do what you want me to do and be what you want me to be if you'll just help me. And I didn't hurt as bad, and I wasn't afraid anymore. And somehow, that night, I climbed up over that mountain and headed south, where I knew I could find some of Tito's guerrilla armies. And it's a long story how I got with the peasants and how they finally got me with a member of the Red Horse Brigade, a British commando that was a liaison officer, how he got me on up to the in the mountains with Tito's army and covered an awful lot of mountainous territory over there. But I got back, and they gave me the chance to come home, figured I was psycho. And to prove that I was, I volunteered to stay over. And I was still flying when the war in Europe was over. And I changed theaters and was still flying when the Japs gave up. And I got back to the University of Oklahoma in January of 1946, 21 years old, a captain with an awful lot of ribbons and stuff, you know. And I was pretty damn great. And I went in and I told the dean at the Arts and Science School, pre-law, I was pre-med, I went back, thought I was going to be, but I figured out if I went to medical school, I'd be an old man at 27, 28 years old by the time I got out there. And just believe I'd go to law school. So I told them what I wanted to do. And from January of 1946 until September 1949, I completed the equivalent of 7 years university and got my law degree. And the most pleasurable time in that was the last summer in law school, my last semester, because I got a full semester's credit due to the hours I took. Nell and I got married, and we spent 3 months on the campus, Norman, Oklahoma, so broke that we ate okra, fried, boiled, any way you can cook it, and drank coffee black mainly. Once a week, we might go to the show. We'd pop our own popcorn and take with us. And but somehow we made it through and I graduated. I got a job as a government attorney in Tulsa. And we moved to Tulsa and lived it up for a while. 1 year, and that's all I wanted. Then we moved back to the shortgrass country, back home. And things could not have been better. I hadn't been there back home practicing law, but less than a year. And a vacancy occurred in the county judge or the magistrate's position, and the commissioners appointed me. And I served 6 years in that position, finished up that term, was reelected twice, two-year terms. Then I decided I wanted to be a prosecutor, the DA, so I tried that for a while. And it was while I was the prosecutor that bad things began to happen to me. You see, I was overpressured, and due to a series of unfortunate occurrences, I began to drink heavily. And I was prosecuting two armed robbers in one of the biggest cases that had hit that county. And I spun on my heel to emphasize a point to the jury and fell flat on my reputation right there in the courtroom. Well, it was all over the county the next morning that the DA had been drunk while he was trying these guys. The jury convicted him. I didn't have a lot to do with that, but I didn't seek re-election and began to practice law. Now, I'm real interested in the research they've done in alcoholism. They have come up with the fact that undoubtedly, if you're like I am, you have a substance that's in your brain called tetrahydroisoquinolin. That if you drink booze, the booze goes up after its first transformation, mixes with that, and releases what could be the addictive agent in heroin, or morphine. The endorphin system works. And so a drink doesn't do something to me, it does something for me. And then I, of course, developed the phenomenon of craving that we read in the doctor's opinion. And also now they say that we are genetically predisposed toward this condition. This may be true, but all I know in my case, I drank too much, too often, too long. and I became totally and completely dependent on beverage alcohol to exist. Now, when I went into private practice, I had the most tremendous clientele that you've ever seen, big ranchers, bankers, and what have you. And I knew most of them didn't want a drunk lawyer. So I kind of made a list of all my good clients, and I thought, I don't want them to catch me drinking. One by one, they'd catch me drunk. I just marked them off, say they wasn't a very good client anyway, you know. But the bad thing about going into the practice of law is I had the office with my dad. My dad was a frank, outspoken man. I know one morning he came in. He wasn't supposed to be down there that early. I had to get down there to get a drink. But he came in and he said, "Son," that's what he used to say when he meant business, "son, are you drinking around my office?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "You're drinking vodka, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "If you're going to drink around my office, drink some scotch or bourbon, something that'll smell. I'd a hell of a lot rather have people know you were drunk than think you were a damn fool." And then I graduated from law school with a Bachelor of Laws. And then a few years later, I did a little more work and got my Juris Doctor degree. And that delighted my father, because then when some of his old colleagues would come in, he would say, "Come here, I want you to meet my son, who's educated far beyond his intelligence." But I began to get arrested. Here are all these old buddies of mine that I'd helped so much while I was in office. The sheriff said, "I'm going to break that little SOB. He never did say whether he meant physically, financially, mentally, socially, but he almost broke me every way that there was to break you. He delegated one deputy that I especially disliked to do nothing but just kind of follow me around. Now, I told you I was a retired judge, and we have what is called the Oklahoma Judicial Conference, which is an organization, a society, if you please, of active trial judges and retired trial judges. And we meet, I don't go anymore, but we used to meet every year, you know. Elect officers, why they did that, I don't know, pay dues. But I held a very unique distinction in that organization. I was the only judge member of the Oklahoma Judicial Conference that had been incarcerated in the county jail of his home county 17 times. I always wore good clothes. I was the best-dressed drunk in jail. I wore white shirts, black string ties, black boots, little snap-brim brush beaver hat, colored glasses, you know. I had fluctuations of weight in my serious drinking days, depending on what I was drinking and how I was looking after my physical condition. I would get somewhat bloated. So I had my fat clothes. And then I would go to work and trim down, and I had my skinny clothes. This particular morning, I was walking along the street about 8:30, Now, my tailor-made boots, I always had a little V-wedge of metal put in the heel. And when I walked, you could hear them clicking, you know. I was clicking along the sidewalk there, and this black and white pulls up, and the Deputy Hoyt Smith opens up the door and says, get in. And I thought, I wonder what kind of advice he needs this early in the morning. So I went over to the car and I says, yes, can I help you? He says, yeah, get in. I says, don't have time. We've got an appointment in my office in just a minute. He said, no, get in. You're under arrest. I said, what for? He says, being drunk in a public place. Well, I thought he was kidding at first, but he's dead serious. Well, he just blocked the courthouse up there. So I got in, rode up there, and he took me up to the sheriff's office. And they made me take off my boots. And I had to take off my belt and give to them. And that particular morning, I was skinny, but I had on my fat clothes. And I have to walk around. You know, if you wear boots, your pants are an inch or inch and a half longer than it would be if you wore slippers. So I had to walk around and hold my britches up. They were too big for me. And they took me up and threw me into the drunk tank. And it was early enough in the morning, they hadn't hosed it down from the night before yet. And there I am in those good interwoven socks. They throw me in there, and I just kind of skate across the room on whatever there is on the floor. I was relating that experience a week or so after it occurred, and this old boy in Jess said, golly, what had they been drinking? I said, I have no idea what they'd been drinking, but I can tell you what they'd been eating. But I swore at that time this would never again occur in my life. Two or three weeks later, walking along the same street, clicking the same heels, whistling the same tune, same black and white, same deputy sheriff. And he says, get in. I said, no, I ain't going. Last time you subjected me to indignities. Well, he reached behind the seat and pulled out his blackjack. Now, you've never seen the blackjack till you see the ones that the Oklahoma deputies used to carry. They're at least that long. They're made out of black leather. And this end is narrow, and then they widen out about this on that wide on the end. And it's big, heavy leather. And they fill that up with buckshot and stitch around the edge, you know. You can just slap somebody with them and just knock them goofy as a dickens. But you hit them sideways and cave their skull in, or at least leave, I believe they call those scalp lacerations, is what the doctor called. Anyway, he pulls this blackjack out and says, this is why I carry this. He says, get in or I'm going to use it. And I said, well, you're sure as hell going to have to. He just sure as hell did. 2 weeks later, same thing again. Pulls up, door opens, get in. I said, no, last time you physically abused me. So he didn't say another word. He just grabbed that blackjack and here he came. Well, I mentioned that I had been a little pugilist one time. And I'd boxed in college. And for a little bitty guy, I could hit pretty hard. And he came around there with that thing. Now, I wore a fraternity ring. Weighed about a half pound. Big old thing, had a Delta Upsilon crest on it, you know. Stuck out about that far. And I had that ring on, and he started to hit me, and I hit him right in the end of the nose. Just as hard as I could. Now, Hoyt had been a drinker at one time, I think, because he had the type of nose that you could see a few veins in, you know. And it was a little larger than it should have been. And I hit him right in the end, and instantaneously, a purple Delta Upsilon crest jumped up right on the end of his nose. Then he hit me. But the legislature, in its wisdom, had enacted a bit of penal legislation that prohibited assault and battery on a police officer. I never, after I got reconciled with the world and was sitting up on the bench looking down, and this poor little old guy comes in, he's all sutured up, and weigh about 100 pounds and couldn't lick his lips. And he's charged with assault and battery on this police officer. And here stands this young man, about 27, 28 years old, wide shoulders, wearing a woolen military cut shirt, you know, with three pleats down the back and a little trim mustache, 1944 haircut. And this little guy is charged with assault and battery on this officer. That's when true compassion came out in me. And that's when I used to tell him, just go sit down, I'll talk to you later. And then I'd tell him that he didn't have to, you don't have to live that way anymore unless you want to. Nell's tender young love for me changed. She was unhappy with my conduct. Now, we had adopted a little six-year-old boy, and that kid loved me. But he got where he hated me. I could see it in his eyes. We'd adopted a little premature baby, and she was just a toddler. And I'd come in, and if I had been drinking, which was frequently, she would turn and leave the room. We had a dachshund. A little bitty dachshund, about that long. Did you ever watch a dachshund turn around and leave the room? Now, this is etched indelibly in my brain. Here's this sweet little toddler turning and leaving, and then Sam, that's what, Long Sam, is what we named him. He turns and leaves the room. His front feet are going out, and those little old back ones are still coming towards you. I can still remember that. I did an awful lot of things that I don't even remember people telling me about. I was accident prone as far as vehicles went. I had three different driving under the influence charges. And I got two of them squashed because of my legal brilliance. And the last one I could have beat, I wasn't even in the car when they arrested me. But I'd sobered up, and it was still pending, and I went back and pled guilty to that thing. I guess that was one of the amends I felt I must make. But things were dark. I lived in a nice home. I drove a Roadmaster. Nell had a Holiday 88 hardtop Oldsmobile, and we were what, quote, quote, respected, you know. But had an office on Main Street. But I was living in my own Skid Row. And we talk a lot about Skid Row. I know Skid Row to me when I was growing up was Reno Street in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. We used to go to the city and Dad would say, this is Skid Row. Red light district, you know. And I don't care if it was the middle of July, you'd go past a doorway, and there'd be an old boy standing in there with his coat pulled up like he was cold in July. And there's always a waybill or a newspaper. Wind always blew on Skid Row. And that's what I thought Skid Row was, but it's not. Skid Row is a personal thing. It's a relative thing. It's a place in the compulsive drinker's life that he finds himself, where there's constant terror, constant fear, despondency, despair, and disgust, no respect, busted hearts and broken dreams, tears by the bucketful. But what makes it so distinctive is the hopelessness and the complete aloneness. Complete aloneness. And those of you that have been there will know what I mean. Complete aloneness. And I had this Skid Row with an office on Main Street, as I said, wearing Hart Schaffner and Mark suits and tailor-made boots. But I was just as lonely, just as despondent and despairing, and just as alone as those old boys down under Beaver Creek Bridge drinking Green Lizard. I woke up one morning at home, laying on the couch in the den, completely dressed. I didn't even care if my car was in the front yard or not. I used to, that's the first thing I'd do, is check, see how I got home. But Nell was getting ready to take the kids to Vacation Bible School, and I said, Nellie, when you get through there, go down and open up the office, and if anybody wants me, you tell them I'm in Detroit, Michigan. And I laid there on that couch and tried to think, but I was sick. And I remember going into the front bath, bouncing off the wall as I went down the hall, kneeling in front of the throne. And we were talking about this last night. We were talking about Sterling W. from Greenville, South Carolina. I spoke with him up in Canada one time, and he told about what he did when he got sick. Well, I used to try to describe upchucking, vomiting, puking, barking. It just didn't describe what I did that morning. And then I heard Sterling. He said, I unswallowed. And that's exactly what I did that morning. And I pulled myself up and looked at myself in the mirror and ran a little cold water over my face. And I stared in the mirror and it scared me to death because I didn't know who I was. Oh, I knew my name, my Social Security number, my address, could still remember my old service numbers. But I didn't know who I was. You see, I had been many, many good things. And yet, the night before, I'd sat on a bench down at the Green Lantern Bar and bought two-bit a bottle of Falstaff beer for anybody that would sit there and drink it and listen to me tell them how smart I was. I went back in and laid down on the couch, and I faced the first dilemma of my life. I didn't know how not to drink. I didn't know how not to drink. And I did not know how to keep on living. And the poem ran through my mind. Some of you I know have heard The Shooting of Dan McGrew and The Cremation of Sam McGee and The Spell of the Yukon. And Robert Service, my favorite poet, in my drunken days I used to read poetry all the time. And he had written one called The Quitter. It said, when you're lost in the wild and scared as a child and death looks you bang in the eye and your sore's a boil, it's according to Hoyle to cock your revolver and die. But the code of man says fight all you can. Self-destruction is barred. You can whimper and cry. It's damned easy to die. It's a keeping on living. It's hard. And I got a little control of myself, and I thought, I've got no one to help me. And I was just as afraid, just as hurt, just as weak as I'd been that night on that mountain in Yugoslavia. And in the same desperation, I cried out, what am I going to do? A miracle of miracles, and the age of miracles is not dead. I heard the same words as clearly as I'd heard them that night. I shall lift up mine eyes into the hills. From whence cometh my help? My help cometh from God that made heaven and earth. And I said, God, I don't know why I'm still alive. Maybe sometime, somewhere, you got something for me to do, but I can't do it here. And it's a long, long, long ways back. But I'll do everything within my power to get back and do what you want me to do. Be what you want me to be, if you'll just help me. And I didn't hurt as bad, and I wasn't afraid. I looked over at the television set, and there on the television set was a 24-hour day book that had been given me 18 months before at Christmas by my would-be sponsor. Now, I had attended way back in 57 an AA meeting, and at that meeting, this came back to me. I heard this man say, you never have to take another drink if you don't want to. All you have to do when you get up in the morning is make an agreement with yourself not to drink for one day and ask God to help you and do your dead level best during the day to live with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one day at a time, you never have to drink again if you don't want to. Then I'd attended a few other meetings when I'd get in trouble and Nell would coerce me, intimidate me. Sometimes she used physical force. But she'd get me to the meetings now and then. And if Alcoholics Anonymous has one fault, this is the voice of experience. It is not made. It is not here for the people that need it. It is here for the people that want it. And not wanting it at that time did not do me any good. Anyway, I got this little 24-hour book, and I remembered what this first speaker had said. And I thumb over there to the day, and I read the thought for the day, and the meditation for the day, and the prayer for the day. And I said, okay, Cleve, we won't drink today. God, please help us. And I took a red ballpoint pen, and I wrote a 1 up in the corner of that page. That day I did a lot of thinking, a lot of reading, a lot of praying. The next morning, I should have been in intensive care in some big hospital because I suffered from acute alcoholism. And but the next morning, I got up and I couldn't wait to get that little book. Oh, yes, always thank God at night for a day of sobriety, and I'd done that. And I grabbed that little old book, and I read the thought for the day, meditation and the prayer. Made the agreement with myself that I would not drink, and I asked God to help me again. I went in and showered and shaved and shampooed and shined. And I put on that black suit and my boots, that snap-brimmed brush beaver hat. And I walked to work, whistling. And you know, I heard a bird singing on the way. After 30 days, I did the same thing, and I wrote 30. These little 24-hour books became almost a diary for me because everything of importance that happened, I would scribble in there. They just last 10 years, and they're filled up. I'm on my fourth one now. And this morning, right across the street, I got up and I got my little 24-hour book, and I read the thought for the day and the meditation and the prayer. I made an agreement with myself I would not drink today. I asked God to help me. And I also made the little prayer, today make me an instrument of thy peace. And I wrote 11,741. That's over 32 years without a drink, one day at a time. Because I humbled myself and asked God for his help. And I think the secret to this, I've done a lot of thinking about it. I didn't ask God to sober me up. I think I had in the past, but I forgot it as soon as I got sober. I didn't ask him for miracles. I just said, I'll do everything within my power if you'll just help me. And I kind of made it a partnership. And I don't think God sobers anybody yet. God won't do anything for us that we can do for ourselves. But we will realize that He will do for us those things which we cannot do for ourselves. The world and life has been so good, there's no way of describing it all. I was privileged to be a charter member of our group back in Warwick, Oklahoma. My sponsor and I started. We got another one. A little later, we got another one. A little later, we got another one. There were five of us. And they called us the Gypsies because we didn't have a group. And we'd go to different towns to the meeting. Every night, went somewhere. And when we were 1 year old, we registered with General Service as the Gypsy Group. There were five of us. Shortly thereafter, we got six. Walter came in. And then on New Year's Day, after a big New Year's Eve, Shorty came in. And a couple of weeks later, Chuck came in. Now, that's eight. That were the eight members of the Gypsy Group as it was formed. And I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that it was founded on Big Book principles. And we're probably as strict in that regard as any group in the United States. To me, it's the best group I ever saw. I never have seen yours, Dave. But it's a good group. And of these eight members, my sponsor, A.C., died of cancer. Pug Tidwell, one of the five, the first five, died of a heart attack. Chuck Shabron, the eighth one that came in, died of cancer. And after 30 years, the other five are all still alive and sober. Because we were founded on the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and not a bunch of hooey. Of course, Nellie and I are happier than we've ever been. She'll tell you mostly about that tomorrow. I will tell you that she's my best friend today. She's got a bad case of Al-Anonism. This spring, we had a big party for 35 consecutive years, uninterrupted years in Al-Anon, and had it in Warwick, Oklahoma, and we had people from California come in for it. And real proud of her. Where is she? I just about lost her. She's hiding out over there. But she's bad about smoking. She smoked a while and she quit. And then she smoked a while and she quit. You know one of those? And to tell you, just her Al-Anon attitude got to do this. Bought a new car. You know how good a new car smells. It's been several years ago. And I said, Nell, I wish you wouldn't smoke in the new car. And she said, honey, that's your privilege. I said, I don't like it. She said, you don't have to. But we get along fine. We get along fine. This little boy that learned to hate me became my best friend. I was his scoutmaster, hunting buddy, fishing buddy. He went in the Navy when I got out of high school, career man. And he wrote home and he said, when I come home later on this year, we're going to get married to his high school sweetheart. He said, they're going to have a big church wedding. He said, will you be my best man because you are? And serious bad events with him being at sea and what have you broke up that marriage. I've got 3 grandchildren in Florida I rarely see. He married another one, and she was a ding-a-ling. And he got rid of her, and July the 4th, on our patio at home, I performed the ceremony. Even though I'm retired, I can still perform ceremonies as a judge. I performed the ceremony whereby son Mike took his 3rd wife. And we hope the 3rd time is a charm. Now, this little old toddler is a dear. When she was 15, she said, "Dad, the kid just can't believe you're not going to get me a new car for my 16th birthday." I said, "Pumpkin, we're just going to have to convince him." You see, I didn't want to get her a car because I had the privilege of driving the little doll to school every day. There she was in high school, still driving. Drive up in the big circular drive, and you watch the mothers and the daddies and the kids in the car in front of you and the ones behind you. They just yeah at each other's throats, you know. No love being expressed. And the kid would get out, slam the car door, and stomp off into the school. Never Rebecca. She never got out of the car. But what she said, "Have a good day, Dad. I love you." That's why I didn't want to get her the new car. She got it on her 17th birthday. But, and she's still that way. She calls me 4 or 5 times a day. Just calls Daddy and says, "How you doing?" I say, "Doing fine. But don't forget I love you." Click. That's it. But she's my gal now, and she's furnished me 3 grandkids. Then, running out of time, 1968, Nell quit smoking one of her times. She said, "Something's wrong with me." She said, "I'm messed up physiologically all over." And I said, "Well, it could be nicotine withdrawal." So she went to the doctor, and she was pregnant. Now, she was a female who had been pronounced incapable of conceiving. And here we are. She's about 40, and I'm 45, she's going to bear me a son. Well, there's no fool like an old fool. And I already knew that in 1988 that my son would win gold medals in the Olympics. That is, if they let him off from Oxford over there, because he was going to be a Rhodes Scholar. Well, when Christopher was born, difficult as it was to eventually accept, he had Down syndrome. And this just didn't set well with me at all. Because really back then, and that's 28 years ago, they called it Mongolism mainly. And mongoloid was a dirty word. And we stood by his little old bed and said, "God, change this. Change this." And God performed a greater miracle than that. God changed us. And let us accept what we couldn't change. And it's a terrible thing for you to hear me say, but I don't know if I'd change old Chris if I could now. He is the greatest lover this world has ever known, because he loves for fun and for free. He loves everyone. And I can tell you why he does this. I tell you why this Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous works. When Chris couldn't say Christopher, that's his name, he was sitting in Nell's lap in the den one day, and he looked up and said, "Mama, I love you." Looked over at Rebecca and said, "Becca, I love you." looked at me, said, "Daddy, I love you." Then he just threw out his little old chest and said, "And Philipper, I love you." That's what he called himself. Well, we chuckled about that, and I used to have to drive to Duncan, another county, whole court up there all the time, too. And I was driving up down the highway, and I was chuckling about what Chris had said, and it dawned on me. Christopher can care for me and his mama and his sister because Christopher cares about Christopher. To him, he's the greatest thing in the world. And Christopher can love me because Christopher can love Christopher. And then I thought about Alcoholics Anonymous. It's got a chapter on how it works. Did you ever stop to think why it works? Take an old, pukey, sarcastic, unlovable, smelly drunk like me, repulsive drunk like me. He can walk through the door, just like that back there, into this room of people, and find himself in the midst of the strangest breed of cats that God ever created. Because the people in here not only can tolerate a drunk, but they can care about him, and they can love him. And here's a person that has no prestige, no self-respect. He is a no-thing, a nobody. And he walks in and you put your arm around him. And you say, "Glad to see you. Come on in. Let's have a cup of coffee and talk." And he's astounded because here is a person that looks clean and smells clean and is clean that puts his arm around him. And inherently, he stands just a little taller in his own mind's eye. And they tell him, "You're a child of God." Yes, either we all are or nobody is. You're a child of God, and you're entitled to personhood. And respect. As one of God's children. So he stands a little higher, and when you tell him this, he thinks, "Well, the one that's talking to me is one of God's children too, you know." So to the extent that he lets you bolster him, he can begin to at least respect you. Then he comes back, and you tell him this again, and you care for him, and you love him again. Slowly, he builds up to the point that he can like himself. Then he builds up to the point, because of your input, that he can love himself. And this is fine, but the greatest miracle occurs when he learns to love in return. And then he's sitting in a room such as this, and here comes another old, repulsive, obnoxious, smelly, stinky drunk. And who's the first one up to put his arm around him? To carry the message, to pass it on. They talk about the squirrel cage of alcoholism. Going faster and faster and faster, or the merry-go-round, going faster and faster and faster. I submit that there's a merry-go-round in the squirrel cage of recovery that's based upon the giving and the receiving of love. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem. But Alcoholics Anonymous is much more than that. Alcoholics Anonymous is a brotherhood of the second chance, where a very repulsive, obnoxious, smelly, pukey, drunk like me can walk into a room like this with people like you. And because of what he finds there, learn to love and be loved in return. And for this, I thank you.